We have judges. We have climate science. Then we finish things off with a jam session. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The ballots will be full this election season with state, regional, and local races. Add to that ballot measures and amendments. But how prepared are you to vote in the primaries next Tuesday? For example, do you know the importance of the judicial candidates?
But in their ruling on any particular case, they could have an effect over our lives as a society.
Plus, depending on the poll, roughly 3 out of every 4 Americans believe on some level in global warming. We're going to meet a woman who wants to get everyone on board. And Sweat Records is a Miami institution providing a space for music lovers. It's now entering the record label business. And we'll learn about some of the bands, including DJ Richie Hell, that are releasing their first Sweat Record albums. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. We're less than a week away from the primaries, and there's a lot to prepare for. If you're a Republican or Democrat, you will be voting for a gubernatorial candidate, and of course, there's the Senate race. There's also going to be a lot of other local and regional races, as well as ballot issues to have to decide on. And one of the things on the ballot is going to be judges. But how much do people know about the judicial candidates? How do you decide which one to vote for, considering they don't affiliate with any party? We're going to look at judge races in Palm Beach and Broward counties today and maybe help you as you decide which name to vote for when you're going to the ballot, to the poll. Well, first, we spoke with Rick Christie, editor of the editorial page and director for the opinion editorial content for the Palm Beach Post.
For August 28th, they're looking at actually 5 races, 2 for the county court and 3 for the circuit court. Mainly that's due to retiring judges.
From your experience, do you get the sense that voters are well-versed in understanding the candidates and what it means to pick a judge?
From my experience, no, unfortunately. I think that they are getting better. I've noticed that over the last couple of years, that voters seem to be getting better and more interested who the judicial candidates are and finding out more about them. But typically, and this year hasn't been much different, they do not know very much about them and tend to call us even after we have run endorsements asking us more information about them. And also, I don't know if this is true in other counties, Broward or Miami-Dade particularly, but there has been an increasing number of judicial candidate forums, because I believe groups like the League of Women Voters and others have noticed the same thing, that a lot of voters are frustrated by the fact that they don't know anything about judicial candidates. So there's been an increasing number of forums put on by, like I said, groups like the League of Women Voters, everything from those guys to your local condominium association. It's really something to see.
So we've got 3 different races for judicial circuit judges. Tell us about some of those races and the candidates.
Well, yeah. In the macro, the most interesting thing about the races is that you have, for the first time, black candidates running for each of the seats on the bench. And that's never really happened before. I think that was sparked by the first black judicial candidate to win a race in Palm Beach County a couple of years ago, Bradley Harper, for the county court bench. And I think also that you just have a number of black attorneys who really want to try to help diversify the circuit court bench as well as county court bench in Palm Beach County, which is woefully lacking. So that in the macro, I think that's kind of the big thing that you see both in the county court races as well as the circuit court races. Now, in individual races, they have their own little bit of drama and soap opera going on. One of the biggest and likely the biggest is the fact that former state attorney Michael McAuliffe, Palm Beach County State Attorney Michael McAuliffe, is running for a circuit court seat. And he's a little bit of a controversial figure because when he was a state attorney and was running for a second term, he dropped out of the race about 8.5 months before his term ended. And not only did he drop out of the race for re-election, he actually quit. He left the job and went to work for one of the Koch brothers. And so that's been a bit, like I said, a bit controversial here, because, you know, people want an explanation as to why, not only why did you quit running for a second term, but why did you have to leave office 8.5 months before? And of course, he's tried to explain that, saying it was an opportunity that he couldn't pass up and so on. But still, it's quite a bit of drama within the legal community here. And in a lesser vein, but somewhat interesting, you have one of the candidates, Maribel Reynoso Coleman, who is a strong candidate regarding her experience and so on in her group that she is running in. However, there's been some personal and professional issues that have been brought up regarding an affair. But it wasn't just an affair. It was an affair with a client during a divorce case. And so that has popped up as a little bit of soap opera in her race.
Do you get the sense, though, that, you know, in the world that we live in today with social media, that maybe judges, I mean, they can't campaign like, somebody running for governor, but that they're getting a lot of attention, maybe not good attention, but they're getting a lot more attention than they used to?
Mm-hmm. I would say yes to that. And that's a good thing. I think that I have, you know, said in the past that more and more these judicial races are because people need to realize just how important they are and who you decide to pick to sit on the bench. And mainly because when you think about it, most people, and, you know, don't end up having to go to court. But when you do think about it, no one touches your life really the way a judge does. Sometimes in very unpleasant ways, as I'm sure you can understand. So it's important that you have a say in who is sitting on the bench making those kinds of decisions. They're not just important in touching your life maybe individually in a case, but in their ruling on any particular case, they could have an effect over our lives as a society, and much more so than most other elected politicians. Because once somebody gets a seat on the bench, they are less likely to leave unless they really want to. Unless you do something really controversial, you really are probably just going to be retained every term on merit. And so that can be a pretty long appointment, rather than in many other cases where you're term limited. Judges aren't term limited. They can sit until they have to, well, they're term limited by retirement age in Florida. But other than that, they don't have to leave the bench. So they could be, if you're 35 years old, you can sit on the bench for another, 35 years? And have a big impact on the lives of people in Palm Beach County.
Again, talking with Rick Christie, editor of the editorial page at the Palm Beach Post, talking about those judges. You got judges on the ballot coming up on August 28th. Rick, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
Oh, thank you.
And now I want to turn over to Rosemary O'Hara, editorial page editor of the South Florida Sun-Sentinel. She told us some surprising things about how voters pick judges, like picking the name at the top of the list. There was a study from Sam Houston State University in Huntsville, Texas, that shows that just having your name at the top of the ballot can help you gain a lot more votes. So we started by talking about why the editorial board endorses a judicial candidate.
There's so little attention really paid to what happens in the courtroom. So we find that our endorsements in the judicial candidates have the most impact, really. More than people know who they're going to vote for governor, but they don't know who are the best candidates for judges. And so I think in these races, our endorsements really matter the most.
And what kind of questions do you get from people? I mean, I wonder how often they even ask you, but what sort of things are they asking you about who the judges are and how, you know, do they lean on certain things? I mean, what questions do you get?
Why aren't you telling me what party this candidate is from? And I explain judicial races are nonpartisan. In fact, it's against the judicial canons for candidates to mention what party they belong to. The other question I most often get is, you know, these judges in group 38, is that my district? You know, which ones do I vote for? Judges are elected countywide. It's just that they run for a particular seat. So that group responds to a particular seat, but not a geographic area.
So what's the importance of, say, a county judge compared to like a circuit court judge?
Well, the county court judge is considered the people's court, and it's where people for cases that are under $15,000 and more minor disputes. And people often represent themselves in county court, small claims. And the judge really has to be somebody who doesn't give advice to these people who are before them, but has to have a temperament that tolerates people really not knowing what they're doing. The circuit court judges deal with the more complex cases, the business litigation, the medical malpractice cases, the capital cases where the death penalty is imposed. So the circuit court is where the serious stuff happens. And sometimes people will start in county court and hope to graduate to circuit court because the cases are more interesting.
I noticed, too, you know, during this time of year is I'll see signs. I'll see a lot of signs everywhere. But it's not like when I'm, you know, watching television and I see all those ads for the governor or for Senate. It's different with judges and how they can campaign or really how they can get their name out there.
It's, you know, the election of judges is complicated, as he said, because it's so difficult to find information out about them. And they're really not allowed to talk about themselves. I mean, they can say, you know, where they went to school and what their practice history's been and how many trials they've taken to a jury. But they can't talk about the differences in the race. And so it's tough to evaluate the candidates. Actually, the way that we do it, just so you know, is we bring the candidates in a race in together. And one of the things that we look for in that case is temperament. You know, how do they handle themselves when asked questions and how do they deal, you know, with the person sitting beside them? Oftentimes, the reason that you'll see some incumbent judges get a challenger is on the issue of temperament.
You know, I wondered if because maybe there are people who don't know who the judges are or, you know, what the candidates are, I should say, for any judgeship. But having your name at the top of the list, does that help?
This year has been the name game in Broward County. It's believed that if your name is first, you've somehow got a 10 percentage point advantage. And so we have people now hyphenating their names so that their last name begins with an A. The most famous case that led to a lawsuit here is a candidate named Jason Allen Rosner, who always practiced by Jason, middle name Allen Rosner. But about a year ago, as he was preparing to run for judge, he started hyphenating his last name. So the candidate who was going to be first on the ballot, Melissa Donahoe, sued to say, you know, that's not really his name. His name is Rosner. But she lost the lawsuit because there's really no law about, for a judicial candidate, what your name has to be. So if you start going by a new name, you can use that name on the ballot.
You gave me a little bit of a taste just a second ago of, you know, the process the Sun Sentinel goes through in trying to figure out who is the best candidate. When you talk about judges, you bring them all in and you talk to them and you meet them. So, you know, I'm just wondering what else is in that process and how do you make that decision? How does the editorial board find the judge they want to endorse?
Well, we look for experience in the courtroom. Have they handled litigation? Have they taken cases to the jury? We look to see, are they good? Have they got experience managing something? Because managing a courtroom and managing a docket, there are a lot of moving parts and you need to know, be efficient. We value diversity. We want the bench to reflect what the complexion of our community looks like. We prefer candidates who come from good jobs. Oftentimes we see people who are in solo practice who are really struggling to get by, who are running for judge because it's a good job. The county court judges make about $151,000 a year. In circuit, you make about $160,000.
Is there a unique race that we should be watching for?
We have three incumbent judges who have drawn challengers. Most of them, again, have drawn challengers because of temperament. Something happens when a judge has been on the bench for a long time, apparently, you know, and the challengers say that they're rude or imperious. We've got a case of Stephen Lustig, who built the Ticket Titan franchise in Broward. A multimillionaire is running against an incumbent judge, Robert Lee, because he says, you know, judges get imperious. Judge Lee will say, I'm tough, but I'm not rude. I expect people to show up on time and be prepared. So that's one. We have another one with an attorney, Rhoda Sokoloff, who's challenging Judge Michael Davis. And he was, his sin, I guess, is in first appearance court where they just run people through, you know, what the charges are and bond hearing. He got frustrated with some public defenders. It was caught on camera three times. He now has been chastened and, you know, changes his attitude. He's in a new position and his demeanor appears to be fine. So we stuck with him. And the last one is Attorney Michael Heiss, who's challenging Broward County Judge Robert Diaz. This isn't the first time the incumbent Judge Diaz has drawn an opponent, in part because he finds himself in controversy. The most recent is about his habit of calling females in the courtroom miss when they would like to be, you know, called by their name or counsel if you can't remember the name. The best judges don't draw challengers. So if an incumbent draws a challenger, generally that's a reflection that people in the courthouse have an issue with that person.
That, again, is Rosemary O'Hara, editorial page editor of the South Florida Sun-Sentinel. We also heard from Rick Christie, editor of the editorial page of the Palm Beach Post. If you live in the Miami-Dade County area, reporter David Ovalle has done coverage on the candidates here that we've included on our website, WLRN.org. All right, still to come, we're going to meet a woman who has taken upon herself to teach the basics of climate science to everyone, especially those who don't believe it's real. That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. So how much do you understand about climate change? If one of your friends asked you, could you explain what is making water temperatures hotter each year or making the ice caps melt, what would you say? Caroline Lewis has your answer. She founded the Clio Institute in 2010 and has focused her efforts on amplifying conversations around climate change. Lewis was recently named by Time Magazine as one of the top leaders changing the American South. Through Clio, Lewis and her team have held town halls and events where they break down climate jargon into what she calls little nuggets of information. On August 27th, the Clio Institute is teaming up with WLRN for a special event on climate gentrification. It's the next stop in the Freedom to Breathe Tour. This is a vehicle that is traveling across 9 states in 21 days to hold events that will inform the public about the impacts of climate change on social justice issues. Lewis joins Sundial to discuss the challenges of communicating the threats posed by sea level rise and the importance of a better climate-informed public. And if you have any climate change questions for Mrs. Lewis, we want to hear from you. Tweet us at WLRN Sundial, post on our Facebook page, again, WLRN Sundial, email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Better yet, call in 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. Any question at all, Maybe you're a denier. I want you to listen in, just hear her out, and go ahead and pose a question to her. We'll see what she's got to say. Mrs. Lewis, thank you so much for joining me today. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
All right, so I want to know first, when did climate change and the understanding of climate science become important to you?
Well, I am a high school science teacher and a high school principal by trade, so I've always been aware of what is happening environmentally. And in 2010, when I was forming a nonprofit to sort of engage disengage adults on environmental issues, the climate scientists, the big guns down here who write the IPCC reports and the NCA reports, you know, the usual suspects like Hal Wanless and Ben Kurtman and good folks, when they showed me the current data in 2010 and the rate at which it was changing, I went into a little bit of a panic and I said, okay, let me break this down for the public. Give me 6 months. Everybody will know this and we will be moving forward with climate action.
So you were a science teacher, though. I mean, the word climate change, and we were having this conversation in the newsroom. I'm thinking back when I was in school, even through college in the mid 90s, we didn't talk about this. When did you start to actually think like, did you always believe in it?
Always, because I think it's global warming. But the fact that it's not always warm, there's snow outside and all of that, really, it's a misnomer that people think, well, if it's cold outside, there is no global warming.
And that's the first term that really popped up, global warming,
correct,
then climate change.
Right.
Help us understand, by the way, just as a reminder, a primer, what's the difference?
Well, global warming is leading to a change in climate. So it's one is causing the other. If you think about it, if every drop of sunshine that ever hit the Earth stayed on Earth, what would happen?
I mean, it has to bounce away because if we heat up.
So all day long and all night long, heat is escaping back out into space. Thankfully, we have greenhouse gases to trap some of that outgoing heat so we could live like we are accustomed to. But what we have now is an accelerating rate of buildup of those greenhouse gases. So the heat that's trying to escape is getting trapped at a much greater level. And the rate at which we're putting those greenhouse gases is affecting how much heat is being trapped, which is affecting the climate system and all the disruptions we read about.
You talked about in 2010, that's when you had this panic, and then you decided, no, I've got to help people understand this. You said, give me 6 months. So what did you do in those 6 months?
In those 6 months, I took very complex science and I broke it down. I broke it down into consumable nuggets with the scientists for accuracy, but with the high school teacher in me, so that people could say, oh, so it's the amount of that greenhouse gas that's causing the warming, and it's the warming that's causing the sea level rise, and it's the sea level rise that's causing the salt water intrusion, and that's why we're running out of fresh water, and that's why they want the high land in Miami now, because the low-lying areas are flooding because of sea level rise. So it was connecting the dots. We really came up, we went from amplifying the conversation to bridging the divide between science and society and really doing climate 101s to break down climate science, seriousness, and solutions. And let me just say, I'm so proud of WLRN. You brought me in to teach a climate 101 to all the staff here, and it was amazing. Because everybody can connect the dots. It's not rocket science. Well, it is crazy science, but the basics are very accessible, and that's what I do.
The number again, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. What questions have you ever had about the issue of climate change or global warming, how we're teaching it? Maybe we're not teaching it enough. And if you think it's a hoax or you're a denier, okay, what's your question? What do you want to ask? You know, is it something that people may convince you of, or are you going to stay steadfast that it's not real? 800-743-9576. What led to the start of the Clio Institute, and really, what's its mission?
The Clio Institute right now is laser beam focused on driving climate action. So climate action means adapting to the changes that are here and that are coming that we can't prevent. And action is mitigating the causes. If you know your boat has a hole, you just can't keep bailing water. At some point, you need to fix the hole. So we want to drive action on both ends, bailing water and fixing the hole.
Why do you think this issue is so politicized? Because if it's ever brought up in politics, you got sides that entrench themselves, and they will fight to the end on what they believe. And it's just but politics. You'll hear politicians, and either they're going to use this as part of their platform, or they really try hard not to even discuss it. I mean, we had a governor who, really until recently, I never heard Governor Rick Scott even say climate change.
Exactly.
In an ad recently, I heard him finally say it.
You know why?
Why?
They're finally saying it because the public is demanding it. And they know if they want to please their constituents, they better not run from climate change, especially in the state of Florida. But I think that the reason, well, first of all, I think it is a political issue. Climate change needs policy to confront this issue. It's not a partisan issue, and they've made it one. And I think that happened because of oil, coal, and gas money. Let's just be blunt. People who are beholden to that fossil fuel lobby, they're held captive. So it is in their favor to promote the disinformation campaign that they have been so successful at.
There is no wrong question here. We want to hear any question on this, because if you want to understand, I mean, in, as you said, it's not that it's not rocket science, but it's still science. Science could be tricky. You tried to make it simple, but science is science. Science is tricky. So let's, again, no question is wrong. Let's go to the phones. I want to start with Bob in Fort Lauderdale. Bob, thanks for holding on.
Hi. Can you talk a bit about the relationship between climate change and earthquakes?
Connection between climate change and earthquakes. Bob, thank you for the question. Is there a link?
Well, you know, one thing I know is I know what I don't know, and I don't know that.
Okay.
So I would say maybe fracking, which is indirectly linked to climate change, because they call natural gas Israeli fracked gas, and the process of fracking and penetrating into the bedrock and doing lateral blitzing of the rock has been leading to increased number of earthquakes and tremors in places that never had them.
Like in the Midwest.
In the Midwest, which is, and in parts of Texas and Ohio who have never had it, in Oklahoma, they're having it.
And what about, you know, we hear this, we're in the middle of hurricane season, and we always ask this question, or we hear the question, is there a link between the climate change, between global warming and increased storms, increased intensity of storms? Do we know that?
For sure. We definitely link the intensity of storms to climate change, because when you think about it, 93% of the heat that is being trapped by those greenhouse gases, the heat that's trying to get out into space and we're keeping it on Earth much longer than we need to, is in the ocean. And if the ocean is that warm, you think about a hurricane. Every time a hurricane goes over water, what do the meteorologists tell us? It's intensifying. So every time a hurricane is over a warming ocean,
warm water is a fuel for
right.
a hurricane.
So the size and intensity of hurricanes are completely affected by the warming oceans and the warming atmosphere.
I'm only saying this because I had read it somewhere, but I don't know. There were scientists saying that, and we saw this last year with Irma. Irma at one point was a Category 5, and it stayed that strong for almost a week. And some are saying now, at some point, we may see Category 6 we've never seen before.
Scary, isn't it? Yeah, well, look at the size of these hurricanes that are here now. The only good news is that they're predicting fewer hurricanes, and that has to do with ocean currents and
for this year,
winds.
Yes.
Yes, but I think it's Russian roulette with these hurricanes, isn't it? We had a 10-11 year gap without any hits, and then Irma came by. So we are one bad hurricane away from a different future for Florida, I think.
Bob, again, thank you for that question. Again, that does go back to there have been a lot of stories in looking for that connection between fracking and earthquakes. The other thing I wanted to get to real quickly is this, is so you go around and you're basically trying to teach people, you know, the science behind climate change, and you try to simplify it. What happens when you run into somebody who straight up says, nope, I don't believe in any of that?
Well, you know, it has happened. Most of the people who come to our classes and courses are self-identified, so they're kind of in the choir, so to speak. But we've been hired by cities like the city of Fort Lauderdale and Wilton Manors and Miami Shores and Pinecrest. Lots of cities have hired us to do climate 101s for their entire staff. And when it's mandatory, you're going to have some deniers in the crowd. So one group of policemen and fire chiefs in Fort Lauderdale were very inattentive during my climate 101 session and actually accused me of doing it for the money.
Wait, you had somebody that was accusing you?
Yeah, of saying, I know why you're doing this climate 101. I said, you're so on to me. I am richer than I know what to do with. Every day I wear different clothing. My jewelry is.
But you know, I want to know from you though, like how often do you run into a climate science denier, and what's your approach? How do you approach them?
Well, once I had them in an audience, and the audience took them on. I had four climate deniers.
Oh, the audience.
Yeah,
took,
the okay. audience was like, leave her alone kind of thing. But they were also, check your facts. I mean, we had people who were saying that, and quite frankly, when people say they don't believe in climate change, I get crazy because you can't say I don't believe in gravity. If I drop this pen, it's going to fall.
Okay.
So there you go.
All right. I'm gonna play a little devil's advocate with you here in just a minute. Again, I'm talking with Caroline Lewis, founder and executive director of the Clio Institute. She's talking with us about the Freedom to Breathe tour that's coming to the Vizcaya Museum next Monday. It's an event co-sponsored by WLRN. It's open to the public. And if you have any climate questions for Mrs. Lewis, we want to hear from you. Again, 800-743-9576. Let me go to, I believe I have Larry on the line. Larry, welcome to the program.
How you doing?
Hey, go ahead, Larry.
I just want to, I'm here in Miami, and I go to the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Sciences, where they give lectures for the first 5 months of every year. About 15 years ago, I went to one where they talked about the 30 years of a study they'd done in Greenland. They had ice cores going back 400,000 years, and they had seen the temperature and the CO2 levels rise. CO2 levels never got above about 290. The most recent one was done in Antarctica. They have 800,000 years of temperature and CO2 levels. Again, never much about 290. Today, the CO2 levels in our atmosphere measure about 410 parts per million. If anybody doesn't believe that kind of stuff,
well,
they got to be crazy.
Okay, Larry, let me ask you this, and Mrs. Lewis, because I told you I wanted to play a little devil's advocate. So you talk about facts.
Yeah.
Okay, but we live in this world now where, I mean, the news media gets challenged constantly, and people want to challenge facts. And then we keep hearing this, well, we can just make facts the way we want to make them. We can make our truth the way we want to make it. It's a disturbing time. But so people, you've heard this, right, Mrs.
Absolutely.
Lewis? Come on, Larry, you've heard this. People say, well, you know what? I'm not sure of those facts. And I hear somebody else give me different facts. Or, I mean, come on, what do you think deniers, why would they deny facts?
These are scientists that have done these studies. These are not idiots out there. That's the world. 97% of the climatic scientists believe it.
And I would say to all of them this, if you trust science enough to get on a plane, you need to trust the science coming out on these climate numbers. And Larry is absolutely right. What frustrates me the most is the lack of urgency. Even those who get it don't get the urgency with which this window of opportunity we have to stop this planetary change is closing.
Larry, thanks so much for bringing up those numbers. And you know what that is? I remember something that Mrs. Lewis had taught us in that course when she gave us a course. Larry, thanks so much for the call. Appreciate it. Yeah, before I go back to the phones, and I want to get into climate change gentrification. This is something that we're seeing now in different cities around the country, around the world, but I want to focus on South Florida. Just going back real quickly, again, when you're teaching it, because the other thing, too, is about teaching it in schools. I'm trying to remember. This was never brought up in science class. I took a lot of science classes in school, but it was never brought up. Are we teaching any of this in schools right now, in science classes? What's on the curriculum?
Look, there are AP environmental science classes that really address this, but it is not as ubiquitous as it should be in classes. I have a Cushman High School. I'm the principal at Cushman High School, and we have a required class every year for every kid. It's called Society and Me, where the kids wrestle with their issues. They do human trafficking, mental health, all sorts of things. And I did my little climate 101 for them. And one young man in the ninth grade, he picked climate change. And what they have to do is they have to ask two questions, a big question for the world to answer and a smaller question they're going to spend 6 months trying to answer. And then we make them do a presentation, like a little TED Talk in April. And this young man, he picked climate change because he was very confused as to if it was so urgent, why he didn't learn any of this in elementary and middle school. So his big question for the world when he said, my name is Sebastian and my topic is climate change, my big question is, while we're building a better future for our youth, how can we build a better youth for our future? And his small question was, how can we incorporate climate change into what we teach elementary school kids so they understand the fight that they're in?
That is lovely. That's actually very lovely. Let me get to this before we run out of time, and I want to get another call in here. We've talked about this on the program. We've talked about this, you know, WLRN reporters have covered on this issue of climate change gentrification. So basically, I mean, as we see the seas rise and that starts to change and shift the topography, I mean, our certain neighborhoods are going to disappear at some point. Higher ground becomes more valuable. But I mean, how do you define here in South Florida what you've seen with climate change gentrification? What is it?
So what it is literally recognizing, if you look at Miami-Dade County as a flat pancake, if you put your two hands together flat on a table, and then you elevate your middle fingers or your pointer fingers only, you have a ridge in the middle of Miami-Dade County. That ridge is where we put the railroad tracks. And that ridge, historically, is where the black and brown people lived. We're talking Liberty City, Little Haiti, Alapata, and so on. Well, when you look at the east part of Miami-Dade County, Atlantic Ocean, they're experiencing tidal flooding as the seas rise because they're very low-lying. When you look at the west part of Miami-Dade County near the Everglades, very low-lying, so they're experiencing flooding too. So this ridge that is 15 to 18 to 20 feet above sea level in parts, it's like the Rocky Mountains for down here. And so people, developers, are looking at elevation more and more for several reasons. Do you want to buy and build on low-lying areas and have to account for that sea level rise and pay higher insurance? Or do you want to get on the ridge? So the people on the ridge are telling us that they feel a predatory acceleration of developers knocking on their doors. Some of them are being told by the developer knocking on the door that they're in foreclosure before they even know that they're in foreclosure. So it's a double whammy for those without resources. They cannot live paycheck to paycheck, have a disaster like Irma, miss 2 weeks of work, and not fall behind. So they are vulnerable.
I want to get one more call in here before we finish up. I want to go to Bill in Fort Lauderdale. Bill, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks.
Go ahead, Bill. Yeah, go ahead.
My basic problem is that we have a fatalistic problem. I said it better to your screener. We feel helplessness. Helplessness is the fundamental problem. And I'll put it this way. What can I do? Well, okay, you can like use half the toilet paper. You can brush your teeth. You can ride your bike to work. You lower your carbon footprint. This all sounds great. But we all know that the 1% have 5 orders of magnitude the carbon footprint of the 99%. And I don't know, you just got to draw the line somewhere. We all know it. So when you're being told to reduce your carbon footprint, you know that the rich guy, he's not reducing any carbon footprint. And we also know that we live in a system that I don't really get to choose. I got to go to work. I got to get there.
So
I have to get on an airplane. I mean, you're like, what are you supposed to do?
All right. And Bill, I apologize. I don't want to cut you off. This is a great point. This is why I wanted to end with this, only for time. So basically, one little person, Bill, one little guy, what can I do? What can he do?
Well, you're asking me, are there any big answers? Well, you know what? There are big answers. It's going to take an economic and political will to change this. Agreed? So if we get a carbon tax, we can really start doing this, or a carbon fee.
So a person like Bill can do the little things, but really in the end, what?
We have to elect
the politicians.
Absolutely. Okay. And let me tell you, we reach across the aisle at the Clio Institute. We have both stripes of politicians on our leadership circle. This is not a partisan issue. And if they stop and do it, Jim Kasson is my hero. He's a Republican. He was the last mayor of Coral Gables. And he came to one of our Clio roundtables knowing nothing. And he went from 0 to 110 seconds and mapped every square foot of Coral Gables. And now he's on a stage speaking about climate action.
And I've talked to him before. He's an interesting person. He cares deeply about this issue. And yet, I remember once sitting in his office, he said, trying to get the people of Coral Gables to talk about climate change. They want to talk about why my trash isn't being picked up, why the neighbor's allowed to park his car on the grass, this, that, whatever. I got to stop it there. I got to get you back.
Please.
I got to get you back.
I would love to be back. Caroline, thank you so much.
Caroline Lewis, founder and executive director of the Clio Institute. Again, they are doing the Freedom to Breathe tour. It's coming to Vizcaya Museum next Monday, an event co-sponsored by WLRN. We'll have more information on our website. Remember, find us on Facebook or Twitter because we want to hear your thoughts on this conversation. Just check out WLRN Sun. Caroline, thanks again.
Thank you.
Still to come, one of Miami's mainstays for music lovers now entering the record label business. We're going to have a little jam session coming up here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. For 13 years, Sweat Records has become an important place for Miami's music aficionados. From vinyl releases of mainstream artists to exposing the region's underground scene, the record store has been a space for music discovery and live performances. Well, this Sunday, Sweat Records will take on a brand new project. They're launching their own record label. The label will feature talented South Florida musicians and undiscovered music from local artists. Lolo Reskin is the owner and founder of Sweat Records. She joins us now to get a preview of some of that music. And they have a big party coming up, by the way, a Sunday release party, to talk about all of that and more. Lolo, great to have you back.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You've been in Miami 13 years now as the record store is a staple of independent music. Why transition to having a record label?
Well, the main reason is that we actually have a vinyl pressing plant in town again. And we think that's so amazing for the local scene at large. We thought we'd get a lot more local releases in once they opened in 2016, but it hasn't been as many as we had hoped for. And there's so many talented artists that we interact with all the time, and we just couldn't not do it. We just sort of had to get some balls rolling because we love these artists, and we know we could sell so many of their records and turn so many people onto them and help them get the fan bases that can help them sustain actual musical careers.
What was the process in finding the first performers for this release?
I mean, we all listen constantly at the store. I'm also a professional background music programmer, plus the stuff with Sweat, and I'm a DJ, so it's my job to listen to music. So we listen to a lot of stuff. So there's local bands that, you know, rise through the fray and really get you sometimes. And Dracula, which is one of the first artists we're putting out, are definitely one of those groups. They're incredible live. They're a duo. They do this beautiful acoustic sound, a lot of beautiful melancholy songs from centuries past, and then up to modern covers of people like Selena and folk icons like Vashti Bunyan.
All right, you're jumping the gun on me because I want to talk about them. Let's do this though. I want to talk about. Let's go through a couple of these.
Sure.
One of the artists on this newest release is in an unreleased track from an iconic Miami performer. Let's take a trip back. For a moment to Miami in the 1980s. I'm trying to remember how old I was. Okay. Peak disco era. The city's dance scene is starting to grow, and it comes a record store employee turned musician with this very unique style. Let's take a listen. Okay. Remind us of the story of North Miami Beach star Debbie Deb.
Yeah, Debbie Deb was one of the icons of freestyle music, which that sound is called. The main regions where it was popular were Miami, Puerto Rico, and New York. And it's just very much this bass-influenced electro-synth dance pop. And that track, Lookout Weekend, and her other hit, When I Hear Music, were huge dance floor hits of that era and skate floor hits of that era. And we were lucky enough, with the help of another incredible legendary local electronic label called Schematic Records, get together, we found this kind of unreleased track by hers that's just a banger that perfectly goes with these other two. So the track's called Everybody's Jammin', and we are super honored to be able to release it for the first time ever this fall on a 12-inch record with with Schematic Records and Pandisc, which was the original Miami freestyle label.
How'd you find this?
Tapes, man. People store tapes in warehouses and garages, and there's so much interest in music of the past and our local history that all kinds of people are going through these archives and discovering things. And these tapes, DJ LaSpam was one of the people that helped this track come to be because he was, you know, engaged by the guy from Pandas to go through a lot of these tapes and do some archiving.
All right, you mentioned a group just a little while ago, and I wanted to get to this. This was I was excited about this one. The Miami-based folk duo Dracula.
Mm-hmm.
I want to make sure I get their names right. How do you say Doris?
Doris Bello.
Doris Bello.
And Eli Oviedo.
Thank you. Who are they?
They're two lovely people. They're both in their early 30s. They're artists and musicians. They've both been playing music and singing since they were in single digits. They have some incredible influences, and they've been playing music together actually since 2009. They've been best acoustic performer in the New Times before, and have actually, you know, without really having an online presence, kind of by design, gained a really great local following of people who just, you know, love seeing them live. And they play these really beautiful, kind of heartbreaking songs and lullaby versions of other things. They're so beautiful, and I can't stop listening to it myself.
Is it true they sing in five different languages?
They have performed songs in five different languages. The upcoming release will have three.
All right, so here's a portion of an unreleased song off the newest album to be released by Sweat Records. It's called...
The label is Sweat Records Records.
Records. Thank you. I had to get that right.
This is a world premiere.
Thank you. It's called Viente Años. Años. I should know this. All right. Go ahead.
Si las cosas que uno quiere se pudieran alcanzar, tú me quisieras lo mismo que 20 años atrás. Con qué tristeza miramos un amor que se nos va. Es un pedazo del alma que se arranca sin piedad.
I waited for the trumpet. There's something special about this trumpet.
There is. My lovely, incredibly talented professional trumpet player father, Chaz Reskin, played the trumpet on that track for us, which was super nice of him. And we have some other nice guest stars, like a cellist from New Deco Ensemble. And it was recorded at Spam City of Progress Studio. So we really made it sort of a fully Miami affair.
All right. I wanted to get to at least one more here. Another band included in the release is Las Nubes.
Las Nubes.
Las Nubes. Yeah. This is an all-girl lo-fi hardcore rock group. What can you tell us about them?
They're great. They were formerly called SMVT, and they have recently changed their name to Las Nubes. Three women, incredibly talented members of the Miami music scene. They all play in other projects. And I kind of think of them as Miami's answer to the Breeders or a kind of college radio sound like that. But they're so tight. They're all super serious musicians. They work really hard, and everyone who sees them live raves. So we're really excited to help them put out their first piece of vinyl.
I love that you said that, because that was when I was in college radio, a college radio DJ, and the Breeders were at the top of my playlist. Argentinian DJ, Miami mainstay, Richie Hell, is out with a new album. And he's going to be DJing the party on Sunday. I want to play a little bit of him. This is a new track being released.
This one's one of his past tracks, actually.
Oh, one of his past tracks? Okay, this is a past track. It's Lost River. Let's hear a little bit of him. DJing the party. Tell us about the party on Sunday.
Sure. It's from 3 to 7 at the store. We've got Dracula and Las Nubes both playing live. Richie's DJing. We're going to have some treats and some drinks. And people there will be able to pre-order these upcoming releases. Vinyl takes time. We're still putting the finishing touches on a lot of the records. We're really going for quality. Want everything to sound and look as amazing as possible.
And it's not just, I mean, the vinyl, but I mean, will this music be available iTunes,
yeah,
Spotify?
Yeah, every platform digitally as well. We're going to have some really great merch and t-shirts and things like that. It's all part of the package. We're really excited to show the true diversity of Miami's music scene. I mean, Dracula is not the first thing you'd think about if you ask someone, what do you think Miami music sounds like? And that's part of why they're so wonderful. It's a nice unexpected treat. And Richie's original music, as we just heard, is so fun and groovy and does have some of the bass and flavor you might expect, but he takes things in such different directions.
Is that the focus for Sweat Records Records? Is that, you know, it's about finding that South Florida sound, or?
We do plan to put out artists from anywhere, and you know, as we were talking in the store last week, what constitutes local? How long do you have to be here to be considered local? We just, you know, we're impressed with music, we're impressed with artistry, and we're impressed with hard work and dedication, because that's really what it takes to be a professional musician these days. You know, you can't just hang out in your studio for forever. These acts are all putting in work, they're all gigging constantly, and we're really excited to be able to share them with everyone, because from what we've seen so far, they already do have fan bases that love them, and we just want that to grow and grow and grow.
All right, remind us again, Sunday is the party.
Yep, Sweat Records Records label launch party, Sunday 3 to 7, all ages welcome. Bring your kids, bring your nephews, nieces, dates, lovers, everything.
And I want to mention too, because yeah, we were at your store last week and we've got a video up. We were talking about this. It's up on our Facebook and Twitter. Check out WLRN Sundial, and that's the party is on Sunday. Lola Reskin, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Congratulations, by the way. Sweat Records Records.
We're stoked. Thanks a lot.
And we're going to end the show with Little Richie Hell. This is the song Good Moaning. All right, that's the program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. I'm going to check out here so we can just jam a bit. Have a wonderful day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.